The book covers 8 canoe adventures taken by Howard and the gang between 1906 and 1916. Howard Greene kept meticulous journals with hundreds of photographs on each trip. And here to talk about it is Martha Greene Phillips. She just wrote a book published by the University of Minnesota Press called Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journals of Howard Greene, 1906 to 1916. What really got me was 1906 to 1916. I've done a bit of this kind of thing myself, Ms. Greene. How did they do it?
Well, they just went out and did it. I think they didn't think too much about it. They did a lot of planning and organizing, and they wanted to get out in the wilderness and knew how to do it, knew how to plan and what to take. So they just went out.
Well, talk about
it.
He's your father, and mm-hmm. and the members of the gang. Now, the gang sort of changed faces from time to time over these trips, but there were some pretty regulars there. And he was a pharmacist, right, in Milwaukee?
It was a wholesale pharmacy, so he's more the business owner. His father started the business, and he was a pharmacist. Uh-huh. But then my dad took it over after his dad died. Mm-hmm. So he knew the pharmacy business, but it was a different kind of pharmacy in 1900 than now.
I can imagine. So how did he get all these people together? And this was really quite an operation because you just
pick up
and walk.
Well, he'd been wanting to get away. He had mm-hmm. two very close friends who were good outdoorsmen who also liked to get out and do these things. Mm-hmm. And my dad had his business in shape enough to leave it in the care of a trusted person. And his boys were getting old enough that he wanted to get them out in the outdoors and away from Victorian Milwaukee mm-hmm. in a little outdoors fun time, testing themselves and learning how to be woodsmen.
Well, he kept, as I said, quite detailed and personal journals and very observational. What he did afterwards is he bound copies of these, right, and then gave them to the gang after each trip. So talk about the journals and what it was like to arrange them. And I understand you basically have lived with these for quite a while.
Yes, I have. And I always thought they were wonderful things and thought they should be shared. And then I just decided to test the waters, and I went out to talk to various historians, and they went crazy for them. Mm-hmm. So that confirmed that they were worth something, you know, not just to me. And so I spent some time trying to figure out how to get hold of the project, because there were 8 journals. They're all, you know, a couple hundred pages each, yeah. Many photographs. And I actually did a book proposal for a kind of condensed version, because publishing is kind of tough these days, and I wasn't sure I could get a publisher to take as much interest as I would wish. As you can see, University of Minnesota came through with flying colors.
I guess they did. It's a wonderful book. It really
they
is.
They were very excited about it. It's their niche, and they valued them. You know, they knew how important they were because no one else was writing this kind of thing then. Mm-hmm. It's well before Sigurd Olsen and, you know, all the Boundary Waters people. It was before the Boundary Waters.
Right, it was. In fact, that's part of the charm of reading the journals, was how they managed to do what they did, because these were basically river and lake trips, and they were a lot of coordination, and we'll get to that shortly. But we've talked about the journals, and they really are fascinating, but and very detailed, and it really almost kind of like a day by day, hour by hour in some cases.
It is.
Plus observations as well. But what also caught my eye was we knew exactly what they were eating, because he kept track of that, and also their sleeping arrangements. I mean, these were diagrams.
Yeah. That I got the biggest kick out of myself. I just thought it was, and some of that was tongue-in-cheek. Mm. You know, my dad had great wit, and a lot, as you go through reading the journals, you'll find that he has a lot of pet names for things,
yep.
and some of them are very irreverent, and I think the sleeping arrangements was just kind of another evidence of that. You know, this is how we slept.
Well, talk about the camera, because this was a large, what they call large format camera. I think it was a Graflex. But, oh, my goodness, that must have been difficult to negotiate.
It's a heavy thing. Yeah. It's a large box, wooden box camera of the kind, not much different than was used to take photographs in the Civil War and things like that, because portable cameras didn't really come into vogue until, well, midway through his trips, there were some good ones. But the camera of choice was this big box camera, and in the first trips, he was actually using glass plate negatives.
Yes.
And then those turned into film plate negatives. They still called them plates, but they were 4x5 negatives. And then there were some roll film ones toward the end.
Yeah, well, those large format negative things, they were encased in a
frame.
Plastic, but something, and you had to push them in and pull them out, and
right.
You couldn't just do it in broad daylight, you know, very well.
No, he had a hood. If you look at pictures in there, you'll see him with a big black hood over his head and over the camera.
Yeah,
they were 4x5 inch negatives in wooden frames, and on one of their trips, the frames got wet. The negatives actually survived pretty well, but they were trying to piece together the frames again so they could.
Well, the thing about large format photography. Is that it's extremely detailed. This is the kind of equipment that Ansel Adams used when he photographed the mountains out west. So
exactly.
What we have here is a collection of astonishingly detailed, beautiful photographs, even the ones that are just kind of camp shots. You know, there isn't a detail you can't see. And it's an amazing record. And I'm pretty sure this kind of stuff doesn't exist many, many other places.
I don't think there are very many others, any others that I know of, as I was sort of researching what was out there. I didn't come across anything like this, you know, nothing. And the number of photographs, over the 8 journals, there were over 800 photographs. So we got very selective for the book. We got down to 270, I think.
Well, you picked the right ones.
Well,
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, not having seen the others, of course. Talk to me about these were trips that were made long before there was lightweight camping equipment and freeze-dried food, but they still covered a fair amount of ground and water within the time they were out. And as I told you before, just reading about it left me tired because they must have been in really good shape because these are canvas covered canoes. This is the heavy equipment tents.
Canvas tents.
Yeah. So,
right.
And
carrying 100 pounds of flour and, you know, how many pounds of potatoes and things.
Well,
amazing.
It's hard for me to realize, and I'm sure that anybody that reads these journals and looks at these photographs, they're going to say they did that, you know.
Yeah, I know. If they understand, they say that. Sometimes I've talked to canoeists, and they say, oh, we've done that trail. And I said, yeah, but, you know, not to take away from what you've done, but you were doing it with Kevlar canoes and Gore-Tex and fleece. It was a little different, you know.
I know. There's a couple of these trips that I have made at least parts of myself in the years that I've been up here at the edge of the Boundary Waters. Now, each of these trips obviously required a lot of planning, including, you know, trains, boats, vehicles, on-the-ground connections, and also some lucky encounters with the foresters along the way. I mean, you had to leave Milwaukee. You got to go by train. You had to on one trip. You had to take this one of the steamships that was running up here. This must have taken a lot of planning and time. And this was all before emails.
Yes. However, there were some interesting things that they had then that we don't have now.
Oh yeah.
And one was there were all kinds of trains available and. There was a train that they could ship the canoes and the outfit up ahead of time to, say, to Duluth. And then they could take a train up. When they were up in Upper Michigan in the Presque Isle, they hopped on the train company said, oh, that passenger train's delayed or something. I don't remember what the reason was exactly. But you can ride in the caboose. So it was very informal. And mail service was incredibly good compared to what we have now.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, when they were on the Wisconsin River, they could send a letter by stopping by some settler's place that lived near a train track, and they'd put it out at the, you know, the siding, and have a letter back and forth from Milwaukee in a day.
Really?
That's and amazing. They used telegraphs a lot, which would, if they could get to a railroad station or, a, you know, any kind of a station house, they could get telegrams until they were deep into the bush. And so there were so many trains available. That was the way everyone traveled. So people knew train schedules, and they weren't, like, having to reserve 3 months ahead to get on Amtrak. Well, they still required organization.
Yeah.
The men divided up the tasks. In one of the journals, he talks about one of the adult men in the gang, you know, was in charge of making new yokes for portaging, and another one was doing this. And as the kids got older, they kind of assigned out jobs to the kids, too, which was fun to see.
What age was, seemed to me that on the first trip, some of them were pretty young.
Yeah, the youngest one was around 8 or 9, and the rest were sort of preteen. These were my dad's sons and their school friends who went. And there was a fairly dependable core group with a few that came and went, you know, depending on the year and the trip.
Well, listen, I've traveled some of these lakes and rivers myself, as I said, in a couple of these rambles, as Howard calls them. I found them particularly interesting, Rainy Lake, the Dawson Trail, Tower to Rainier, but especially the Pigeon River excursion. Now, tell us what you know about this fascinating character, Frank Cugler, and his really pretty impressive camp at McFarland Lake.
Exactly. Well, that trip started off to be kind of a low-key trip. Not everyone could go, and so they were looking for a place they could kind of base camp, and someone, maybe my dad, I think it was my dad, had connections with the lumber company up there, so the lumber company let them sort of camp out near the lumber camp, which was, of course, idle during the summer. And the lumber company was complaining about this Austrian settler who had owns land between Pine and McFarland Lakes, right up from Hovland, if you drive up from Hovland, and was charging them to take logs through between the lakes. He had a little, you know, he had land on both sides of this little channel, and they had a real turf war going with him. So I think my dad was very predisposed to not like the settler and to, you know, side with the lumber company until he met this man who was fascinating, industrious, kind of a loner, going to go out and just, he wanted his freedom and he wanted to be able to live the way he wanted to live. He'd endured religious persecution in Austria and was very bitter about it. So he had a beautiful setup there. He had a cabin. He had a garden. He was raising foxes for fur, and he was a trapper in the winter, and, you know, was doing beautifully. Problem was, he was having a lot of trouble with the lumber company, and at one point, the lumber company, while he was out, away someplace, blasted the channel larger so they could get through better and flooded his fruit cellar, and, you know, a lot of problems were going on there. But Frank Cugler caught my dad's attention, and he became the focus of the trip. They just spent every day with Frank doing something. You know, he's a fascinating character.
Well,
who went on to become, he was on the county board later in life.
Really?
Moved into near Hovland. And he turned up, he's in one of Cal Rutstrom's books. I had read the book, and then I was looking at it for something. It's like, that's Frank Cugler again. And then it was.
Well, he was a very handsome man in the photograph that your father took of him. And
everyone, yeah. When I was going through loose photographs of my dad's before I really got into this project, I came across a picture of this Frank, and I thought, "Who is that? He doesn't look like anyone in my family." You know, he's just Hollywood material.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone reacts that way. It wasn't just me looking at him, and I just knew he wasn't in the family. And then when I got into the journals, it's like, "Oh, okay." And he was a great photographic study as well.
Well, anyway, that channel between McFarland and Pine Lake that we all go through in order to get into the boundary waters, and I've been through it a number of times. I didn't realize that it wasn't really there much before.
Well, it was smaller. It's still pretty small.
Yeah.
And someone from up there told me that if you go out at the right time of the year, you can still find the foundation of his cottage on the one of the, just on one side or the other. I was there in the summer, and it was packed with canoeist and brambled, and I didn't try.
Well, anyway, it's very fascinating. And anybody who here in our listenership area that's ever been up the Arrowhead Trail knows mm-hmm. exactly what you're talking about. The thing that interested me was that having been through some of this country that you talk about, or that Howard talked about, you know, the photographs, there's no way that I would recognize anything because it was considerably wilder. But as I understand it, it was also waning. I mean, there had been a lot of fires and logging and this kind
of
thing.
Yeah, it wasn't pristine, as I think most people would imagine when mm-hmm. they think, oh, 100 years ago, it must have been old-growth forest. Well, that old-growth forest was long gone. And in many areas, it was logged off, and there had been fires, whether before or after the logging, I don't know. When they came to an area that had not been cut over, they were very happy.
The other thing that struck me was that Howard mentioned this it was certainly a number of times in each of these eight journals. The fish and all the fish they caught, even to the point of having bacon and other foods spoil because they were eating so many fish. I mean, the number of fish that they caught, I mean, I don't think we have that kind of catch anymore.
No, you're right. I think they caught more fish than on average people do now. But also, their things would spoil so easily because they didn't have any sure. refrigeration ever. I mean, they were taking a side of bacon. It was just a side of bacon and air, not in a cooler. So they had to watch for spoilage a lot.
Well, speaking of food, they did have, and it seems to me in most cases, they did actually hire somebody to come along and cook.
They usually hired someone who was off work from a logging camp, you know, who had cooked from
sure.
a logging camp
mm-hmm.
in the winter. And most of their help came from that. They did have one or two men, depending on what the size of their group, who kind of helped out. They were not outfitters, and they were not guides. They didn't have a clue where they were going, and they weren't carrying all the stuff. You could see pictures of everybody, you know, on the portage just carrying things. But they helped out with, you know, around the camp and with cooking, except for one who was a terrible cook that they
yeah,
barely wait to get rid of.
It wasn't always successful.
Not always at all. And, you know, the men, like I don't remember my dad being too much of a cook, but he obviously knew how to cook camp food. He'd been in the Army and he'd done these trips, so mm-hmm. he could fill in, and I think they did at times with that bad cook.
Well, in editing and arranging these pictures and the journals, so what stood out in your mind about either the people or the events they encountered?
I wish I could have gone on the trips. I guess I'll start it that way. But one of the things that I now feel most excited about still is the relationship these men had. They were good friends. They were out just enjoying themselves. What the opportunity the boys had to be with men as knowledgeable as they were. They were all pretty well-educated, sophisticated men, but who also were very down-to-earth about camping. So these teen boys, you know, learned so much. One of the young men who was a friend of one of my half-brothers wrote, I found his papers in a Chicago library, and he wrote on the back of a picture that he had taken of he and Doc, one of the older men.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, these were the happiest days of my life. I'm so, you know, and he often wrote letters about how fortunate he was to have known Doc. And he gave Doc a copy of a botany book. Doc taught him about the birds. And, you know, they had a month of this every summer.
Well, at the beginning of these excursions, it seems like there were happening pretty much every year. Then there were some longer breaks. Several members of the gang changed. They grew up or grew into other obligations. And finally, it all ends with the Chippewa River trip in 1916. Now, what's your take on this? I mean, is this just one of these things that finally just everybody outgrew? Or?
Well, the boys aged out. The boys were getting to be college age. They were talking about a 10-year span in there, you mm-hmm. know, so they were off to college and things. One of my dad's friends was ill during one of the last years.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing probably was World War I was on the horizon.
Of course.
And that changed everything because then the boys were off and, you know, everything was different. My dad still wanted to do these trips, and he did some other trips that were quite different later on. But he went out to Montana horsepacking in 1926 for 2 weeks. But so he still had the yen to go. But after one of the key figures died in 1917, mm-hmm. after the journals were done, but it just a lot of things changed. The boys grew up. They went off to war. They came home. They got married. You know?
Well, this has been a real pleasure for me personally to ramble with Howard through this book. And
I'm so glad.
And I want to thank you so much. We've been speaking with Martha Green Phillips. Her book is called Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journals of Howard Green, 1906 to 1916. I highly recommend it if you have any interest at all in the whole art, science, and fun of camping and canoeing, particularly here in our region and as well as the St. Croix River and the Upper Peninsula. It's a fascinating book and a tremendous amount of work that you must have done in collating everything, the journals and the photographs.
I did, but it was fun. You know, it was worth doing, definitely.
Well, I have to say the university did proud by you.
Oh, I can't say enough good about them, definitely.
Thank you for taking time to join
thank
us.
Thank you, and I hope that people will buy it and enjoy it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.